All right, nice to have you back with us. Bruce Jenkins joins us. Bruce, how are you today?
Doing well, thanks. How are you doing, Marty?
Well, very well. And as I said, if the playoffs started today, the Giants are in. So you
just end it now, then.
Really? I mean, but you know, the funny thing is, I thought about it, and Kerry Crowley counts it down every time he puts the lineup out. He says, "Now, so many more games to go." There's 149 more games to go, and we've got. I mean, honestly, you got to readjust your thinking.
Well, it's not even summer yet. I mean, the best thing is that, you know, last night, notwithstanding, they've been playing entertaining games. You know, you can't wait to watch them. The rotations is the biggest thing. You know, they're pitching so great. They're playing defense, and all you can think right now is just, you know, stay this course, stay a little bit above 500. Don't let I think the Dodgers in San Diego will probably beat up on each other a little bit, and you know, who knows.
Well, that's what we love about baseball. You just never know where it's going to go. L.A. and San Diego. Bruce, I fell asleep about the seventh inning. It was 5-3 Dodgers. And I said, all right, the Padres threw the ball around, and two runs scored, and Tatis threw the ball in the right field, and blah, blah, blah. Well, about 5 hours later, the game was still going on. And you weathered the storm. You watched the game. This was an amazing baseball game last night.
Well, it was one of the many games I taped off the extra inning package, which I highly recommend to any fan who really wants to watch the entire both leagues in action. And so I was watching it on a bit of tape delay so I could fast forward through the commercials, and I set it for 4.5 hours. Well, at the 4.5 hour mark, I run out, and I'm panicking. I go, oh my God! So I tried to find it live, and sure enough, I found it live on channel, I don't know, 749 or whatever on DirecTV, and. And the game was still going, but amazing game. I mean, there was a pretty good moment for the Dodgers in the bottom of the 10th. Tatis is up. He's playing finally after a long absence. He had a huge home run earlier in the game. And now he's up there with the bases loaded and two outs against a kid named Dennis Santana, who struck him out with a big curveball, a great pitch on a 2-2 count and prolonged the game. And then Corey Seager kind of ended it with a two-run homer off a left-hander. That was really impressive. But they got away from the Padres at the end. But really, great theater all around. And I was just really struck by the crowd noise. It wasn't a big crowd, but it really sounded that way. And it just to hear the crowd still buzzing after a play that happened, you know, 2 or 3 minutes ago, you know, the sustaining energy that it gives you just can't replace that in an empty stadium. And it was so refreshing to hear.
No, in fact, they allowed more fans in than normal. It was over 15,000 that came in.
Yeah.
And they gave them those thunder sticks.
Oh, which... God, that one kid's got to go. there's a couple of them. Get out of there. You're rejected. See you later. Either
really?
Put them away or you're rejected.
Really?
You're going to be behind the plate? Sorry, you're out of there. Nope.
Really? So they had that going last night. But it wasn't a game of three outcomes, you know, homer, walk, strikeout. They were in 12 innings, and the Dodgers won 11-6, but the ball was thrown all over the place. There were home runs, doubles. And it was one of those games that you said, okay, Melanson's going to put it away to the last strike, and he can't do it. Jansen's going to put it away to the last strike. He can't do it. And it was baseball that baseball would like to get back to. That was the interesting part of it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of conversations going on around the game on how that can happen, and that was a good if lengthy lesson on how it's supposed to look, you know. And it's not going to be an easy process, but I think there is a lot of thought about situational hitting and just being smart up there, you know, not being okay with a strikeout when you hit back to the dugout, you know, be upset you didn't do more with it. And the home runs are still going to come. I just think there's it's in the air now that teams, I think, would like to get back to the way it was. And when the teams at the top are doing it, that can only help.
Yeah, it was interesting. Now, going back to the Giants a little bit, they have a way of playing offense, Bruce, that is worth a comment. He likes to platoon. And look, Casey Stengel did it with the Yankees, and, you know, he won World Series and pennants, you know, right and left, and platooning goes back, way back in baseball. But there's something about giving a hitter three or four at-bats in a game as opposed to two. And sometimes you need a little bit more to get your feet on the ground to come up with that one situation. And the Giants are platooning a lot, but they're platooning in the middle of the game, which I think maybe is hurting them a little bit.
Yeah, you run the risk of losing a guy and getting some grumbling in the clubhouse if guys lose sight of their roles. And, you know, maybe it's a good hitter, you know, a respected hitter like Solano or Dickerson or Riaz or whoever it might be due up, and he gets pinch hit for because it's a righty-lefty kind of thing. You know, it's going to work sometimes, and when it does, it's all good. But I agree with you, especially if it's somebody that you're kind of counting on. You know, if a guy like Solano, you've got to trust that he's going to hit everybody. You know, you got to stick with Dickerson if he's having a few struggles, because he just might yank one. Doesn't matter who's out there. I do agree with that. It's something that we're seeing now. And you know, it's a good thing. You know, the Giants have had a 6-man bench, I think, a good deal of the time, which is terrific. And if you've got guys that can come off the bench in situations like that, like a Flores or whoever it might be, you know, that's good. But I do agree with you in essence that, you know, if you start the game, you ought to be able to, if not finish it, at least give more showing than 2 at-bats.
Yeah, I think that's something they're going to have to. Now, last year was terrific, and they were terrific at it. This year, it's more like pinch hitting, and they're struggling. But as I said, only 13 games. They're barreling up the ball. Their BABIP is below normal. And, you know, Grant Brisby wrote a great article in The Athletic about, you know, how times are going to change. So 13 games, and we'll just deal with it at that level. Rule changes. Jason Stark in The Athletic had a wonderful column this week about a couple of rule changes. I want to get your thoughts about it. One is moving the mound back 61 feet 6 inches, and the other one is the double hook rule, that if you have a DH, he can hit, but once you take your starting pitcher out, the DH has to go with him, and then you got to start pinch hitting and blah, blah, blah in that situation. What do you think?
Yeah, it was a great article. You know, moving the pitcher's mound back, to me, I talked to Kruko. He made a great point. It's like, instead of the players, you know, getting together and with everybody, the front office and the managers, and trying to adjust and not be striking out all the time. It's all about too many strikeouts. Too many hitters are striking out. Well, adjust. You know, and what, now you got to move the mound back a foot? I mean, it's may not be that dramatic. We're not going to know until some of the numbers come in from the Atlantic League. And even at that, we're not really going to know, because those hitters aren't like big league hitters. And those pitchers aren't throwing like big league pitchers. So it's pretty radical. Maybe we won't really notice, but I agree with Kruko, is that it's, you know, I would rather see an adjustment at least in place with some progress being made than to do something like that. I really don't think that's going to come to the big leagues. It may never get out of the Atlantic League, but it's something they're trying, and, you know, you want to find out what it looks like anyway. As far as the double hook, I mean, I'm for anything that restores traditional baseball. And it is going to be strange. If your pitcher gets knocked out early and you lose the DH, assuming that you don't just put him, you know, in another position, like you send Giancarlo Stanton to left field or whatever, and all of a sudden your pitchers are hitting in that slot, and meanwhile the other guys, they still have their DH in play. You know, that's a big disadvantage. But I in essence, I love the idea of getting back to traditional game. I really think, Marty, once the universal DH is in play pitchers hitting goes away forever, the traditional game goes away forever, I really think even the most staunch DH defenders are going to miss it a little bit. And anything that restores this, the possibility of still getting the, you know, the strategy and everything that goes along with it, I'm kind of a sick man. I actually like watching pitchers hit just to see what kind of work they've put into it. And I love the real athletes, you know, like Scherzer and Greinke and Bumgarner, who really take it seriously. And then you see a guy up there who just just wants to stand there like a statue. Well, you know, do some work, do something. You learn about guys that way. But anyway, I do like it.
All right. Well, you know, the best advice to the pitcher who's hitting is, if you think you're going to hit into a double play, strike out. That's the best advice. But there have been good hitters. But we'll see. One thing, they'd like to keep the starting pitcher in the game longer.
Well, yeah,
maybe that's a way to do it. But if he's getting knocked around, then, of course, you want to catch up, and you're going to lose a hitter to try to catch up. So I think that one's got a long way to go. I really do.
I don't think that's coming around anytime soon. And another good thing is that it does, if starting pitchers can last longer in the game and that becomes more of a trend, I'm definitely all for that. We've talked about that a lot. So, it'll be fun to be following some of these Atlantic League teams and watch this in action and see what you think of it, you know.
Well, you and I saw the robot ump and we liked it, going to see it. And sometimes you have to see these things in action to appreciate it. But, look, anything that changes is okay. The game evolves. Look, in 1894, the mound was 56 feet. And to move it back to 60.
That was radical.
And that was a box. And you had a pitcher from a box. To move it back to 60 feet, 6 inches, and a mound.
That's
really
dramatic.
You think they built the Panama Canal in the middle of Yankee Stadium, you know. It was just radical. So that's the world we live in. Hey, you wrote a beautiful article this week about Fernando Valenzuela and sort of the anniversary of his first, real big start. Fernando Mania, you talk about that just a little.
Yeah, well, a small group of Giants fans at Candlestick Park at the tail end of the 1980 season might have been able to see what was coming. He came up late and only in relief, pitched about 10 games, about 17 innings late in 1980, one of which was two hitless innings on a freezing night at Candlestick near the very end of the season. And that was so interesting. Before Fernando Mania really took off, in 1980, the Dodgers had to sweep Houston 3 games in L.A. to get to tie them and get into the playoff. And they did. And Fernando pitched in relief, and it was all great. Now they got the playoff game. One day I was there, the day game, and Lasorda decides to start Dave Gultz, which isn't such an odd move, except there was a lot of clamoring for Fernando. Get this guy out there. Nobody can hit him. And, of course, Art Howe hit 2 homers off goals. It couldn't have been worse. I mean, Art Howe, for heaven's sake.
Yes, he did.
But
he took a very close pitch, and Doug Harvey said, "Art, don't take that pitch again." And Art, the next pitch hit a home run, and he crossed the plate, and Doug Harvey looked at him, and Art said, "I didn't take it this time."
Beautiful. That's great that you had that interview. But then 1981. Forget about it. He's unhittable. He pitches basically 8 complete games. His first 8. One of them, he went 9 and didn't finish. But he went 9 for 8 straight games. They win them all, and the crowd start mounting. And there was one game in New York where they sent this kid who really doesn't speak any English and is barely familiar with America. They sent him to New York ahead of the team, so he can meet with the New York press before his start there. And the people are lined up outside. They get a massive crowd. He never let the team down. He had that unbelievable screwball, and he looked up at the sky before every pitch. And how the hell do you do that? And he was just so fascinating, and not to mention the incredible influence he had on the Mexican community and really the entire Latino community in the U.S. and eventually, around the world, Central and South America, and, oh, my God, Cuba, and it was just, and then topped off by, I covered that 1981 World Series, and the Yankees won the first 2 in New York. You're figuring, well, this is not looking good. And Fernando starts game 3 in L.A., and there was a point where he was in a real crisis, a couple guys on, and Lasorda, this time he did trust Fernando. He got out of it. He threw 147 pitches. They win the game. They didn't look back. They won the next 3. They win the title. So that 81 season, Fernando was really unforgettable.
Oh, you wrote a beautiful article. Great. And it's still the effect of Fernando today is felt all over baseball, and especially in the Los Angeles area with the Dodgers. So you pointed that out. Bill Lasky joins us. Bill, did you ever face Fernando?
Fernando and I went at it heavily in 82 and 83. We competed the last game at Candlestick. That was one of the good battles we had. And we had a couple beanball wars, he and I. He threw at me, and I came back and threw at him. He was a pretty good stick, tell you the truth. He could
was.
Hit the ball well.
He won the Silver Slugger one year. In 81, actually. But, yeah.
Yeah, well, Bruce, you guys are talking about pitching. I came up with a stat I saw yesterday. Max Scherzer tied Cy Young and ended up going past him with 2,806 strikeouts. 99 career games he's had 10 or more strikeouts, 22nd on the all-time list. My question to you today, do you think the active players realize what some of these records mean when they break them, and do you think they really care?
Well, that's a good question. I first think about Stephen Curry breaking one of Wilt Chamberlain's records with the Warriors, and he was extremely aware of it, extremely aware of how awesome it was and what it meant because he studies the game. But I don't know that another example from basketball when Alex Rodriguez is about to buy the Minnesota Timberwolves and they asked the young African American rookie star Edwards about him, he said, "I've never heard of him. I don't follow baseball." So I mean, I think there are less and less kids of any ethnicity following the game from a historical standpoint today, if you believe the numbers, the demographics, and whatever, trying to win over the young audience. But there's always going to be kids who know a lot about it, and spent a lot of this week reading about Jackie Robinson and reading about Hank Aaron. You know, when he. All about Hank Aaron and just it's a difficult question because I think there might be less kids like when Marty and I did nothing but study history when we were kids, but you see a lot of players who don't really get it and if they don't care, I mean it doesn't really matter. I mean, but I like it when somebody not only breaks the record, but they'll say something about the person whose record they broke. Yeah. You know this guy was such and such and what he did that year, he had a big game against the Giants or whatever and those stuff, but it's a pretty mixed bag, I'd say.
Well, Randy Johnson appreciated the records, and so did Greg Maddux, I'll tell you that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Those two for sure. I talked to them about records that they had broken. Historical notes today, Bruce and Bill. First game broadcast for the Cincinnati Reds back in 1939 in the great Red Barber. And also, this is the anniversary of Vince Scully's first game for the Brooklyn Dodgers. How about that?
It's pretty wild to think that, television didn't really become a big thing in this country until the early 50s. And now you got 1939. It's apparently only about 3,000 people actually saw the game. It was on an experimental TV station that turned into WNBC in New York. But there's only two camera angles. You could barely see the ball. From what I understand, Red Barber called it Dodgers and Reds at Ebbets Field. But, a light went on for fans around the country. It's like this is going to be cool. I mean, because you knew it was going to get way, way better. And of course, it did. But that's pretty crazy to think about watching a TV game in 1939. What was the other one you mentioned?
Well, and let me ask before we go to Scully in his first game, did you ever come across Red Barber, Bruce?
No, I never did. And, I was a little – I never really heard him. For me, it was nothing until 58, and then I got Vince Scully, and I was hooked for life, and I was fine. I've heard Red Barber several times just, here and there. But
yeah, this is Scully went 67 years, I think, 1950 to 2017. So this was his first game for the Dodgers.
Oh, my God, yeah. Well, one of the broadcasters that I didn't grow up with but that I liked more than anyone was Ernie Harwell of the Tigers. And when Vince Scully was hired in 1949, just before the 1950 season, it happened because Ernie Harwell jumped from the Dodgers to the Giants. He wanted more money and more time on the air, and Red Barber was a huge fan of Vince Scully. He'd heard him. He worked for CBS. He was actually the program director at CBS Radio and the Dodger broadcaster. But he heard Scully calling a football game from the roof of Fenway Park on a freezing day in winter. And he goes, this guy's got something. So he recommended Scully in there when Harwell jumped ship. And next thing you know, in 1950, you got Vince Scully in there with Red Barber and Connie Desmond, whose voice I can't quite call up. But he's 22 years old, and he never looked back.
Boy, Ernie Harwell, Bill, that's one of your guys.
That's my guy. I used to listen to my transistor underneath the pillow all the time, listening to Tiger games with Ernie Harwell.
Oh, God,
great voice.
So
fantastic.
Good. Man, was he good.
Aren't those old? It's not just their old announcers. Well, of course, they broadcast a different kind of game, and they didn't have all the stats and everything else. They really were telling the story.
They were, and they had the benefit of games moving along quickly. They didn't have to tell a story from their childhood on a 2-2, waiting for a 2-2 pitch.
and they did their own commercials in between innings.
Exactly, yeah. They sound excited about Wonder Bread, you know?
No, Wheaties are Sugar Crisp. You remember?
Sugar Crisp. Right. But it's just called Sugar.
Post-Sugar Crisp. Yeah, that was a good weekend for historical moments. The debut of Roberto Clemente is this day as well. How about that?
Yeah. I love reading about Clemente because he's playing in Puerto Rico and getting some attention. And the Giants and the Braves were both interested in signing him. If you let your mind wander there, Clemente in right field and Mays in center. Or who plays right when Clemente shows up in Aaron and they're both getting into their prime. But the Dodgers managed to sign him. And in those days, there were certain rules for prospects that you signed. You had to keep him on your roster for a couple years, or you'd lose him in the draft. And so the Dodgers signed Clemente, and in 1954, they've decided to send him to Montreal, the International League. And you read about this, and one reason they did that was because if you bring him up, this is a very dark-faced man, and you send a white guy down. This is not good in those days, if you can imagine that. And that was a big factor. But so we got Clemente playing for the Dodgers team in Montreal, and they're hoping he doesn't look too good, you know, because they're going to lose him. They're trying to hide him at times, some people claim. But it's funny because it came down to the draft, and he was eligible to be drafted by the Pirates. And Branch Rickey, who, of course, is the guy who signed Jackie Robinson, was running the Pirates at that time and had a long-standing feud with Walter O'Malley. And he couldn't wait to take this kid Clemente off his hands. So the gamble on sending Clemente to Montreal didn't work. He signed with the Pirates, and wow.
Well, the rest is history. What a moment. What a moment. That was good.
Yeah.
Hey, one of our favorites, his birthday is today, and that is the great Solly Hemus. How about that, Bruce?
Well, you know, he really, you know, you talk about your Mays, your Clemente, your Aaron. Solly Hemus really stands above all of them as a player and not just a man.
A long career shortstop, second baseman for the Cardinals, managed the Cardinals, didn't get along with Bob Gibson for some reason. I don't know why. But birthday today, the great Solly Hemus. Well, we've got so much more to talk about tomorrow. It's early, Bruce. Thanks for coming in early tomorrow. You'll be home with us 7:30 tomorrow morning. So have a great day, and I appreciate you being on, as always.
You bet. I'll fire up the coffee machine. Look forward to it, guys.
Okay. Thanks, Bruce. Boy, interesting. One other thing I want to mention to you, Bill. Tim LoCastro, remember he set that record for most stolen bases to begin a career?
Yeah.
I think I was looking at the box score today, and he got thrown out stealing today, his first time.
Wow. He was fast, man. He's got that first quick step, and, boy, he's gone. And I tell you what, another one that I was surprised with, when the Reds left the Giants, of course, the Giants took 2 out of 3. They beat up on Cleveland yesterday, 10 runs, I mean, double-digit runs, and they were hitting the hell out of the ball in Cincinnati. They didn't do that well at Oracle Park for those three games like we saw earlier in the season.
Well, first lefty that the Reds have faced all year long was yesterday. And they dropped Votto down in the order, and the big boys took care of business yesterday. And the Reds did beat Cleveland. Reds are a decent team. You know, it's all middle relief.
It is.
And we'll talk about this with Kerry as well. Bill, the whole game is turned into middle relief. That is the game of baseball. If you have a good middle relief, that they know their roles and they get it done, you can be a winning team. If your middle relief is trouble, you are in trouble.
It's true, and of course we always call them the bridge guys because you want to get them into the closing spots in that 7th, 8th innings, and it's so important in those 6th, 7th innings to get guys that can get outs and throw strikes. I think that's the biggest thing that I'm seeing this year more than any other year. So many walks, these bullpen guys coming in, and they're not even close. They're not even close, Marty.
They're not even competitive pitches.
Yes.
You know, it's one thing you miss by a foot, and maybe they'll swing. They're 3 feet.
Yeah.
It's incredible to me. I'll tell you, the one guy who was terrific was the guy for the Reds on Monday night.
Whew. He was nasty. He had everything going. He had good changeup, good movement on his fastball, sinker. He kept the Giants at odds. They were scratching their head going back into the dugout.
Yeah, yeah, that guy was terrific. All right. Boy, we got a lot more coming up. Bill and I are going to come back to chat a little bit about our next guest. It's Bob Kendrick, and I'll tell you a little bit about him. But we want to celebrate a little bit of Jackie Robinson weekend. And Bob is the president of the Negro League Museum in Kansas City. And Sharon Robinson is going to join us for a short interview that I did with her. We've got a lot to do in this next half hour about Jackie Robinson. So we'll take a break. And Kerry is around as well. I want to get his thoughts. So you're listening to KNBR 104.5 and 680, the sports leader.